Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 2, delivered on January 25, 2017. The title of this lecture is Special Topics.
Today, Special Topics, the Federal Reserve. Before I get to the Federal Reserve itself, I need to cover a subject that is a little more ancient, a little older. You, sir, make a darned good apple pie. And I love pie. Okay? I myself don't make pies. I hunt moose. And I got a moose. And I come up to your door and I knock on your door. And you say, "Who is it?" And I say, "The Prince of Darkness." And you say, "Oh, hello, Professor C." And you open the door and you see that I'm wearing a moose. And you say, "Love what you've done with that moose." Okay? But I say, "No, I don't want to keep this moose. I want to trade you this moose for some apple pie." And you say, "Absolutely." Why, just a while ago, a lady came in with a grizzly bear that she had fought and killed, and I traded her pie for that bear. This guy, another guy, he came a while ago, and he had all kinds of great goodies for me. You know, he had firewood and stuff like that, and I traded pies for that. I said, "Good, here's the moose." Boom. And I walk away with pie and you have moose. Now, madam, what is money? Kind of hard. You know what it is when you see it, right? Talk to me. What's money? Okay, you're close. Money is anything that is widely accepted in exchange. Money is anything that is widely accepted in exchange. So you see, his pies seem to be money because they are widely accepted in exchange for other assets. Do you understand that opens up money to a broad, broad world? Most people think of money as only these dollar bills in our pockets. Well, actually, that's only one kind of money. Historically, that's not even a particularly important kind of money. But this is a kind of money called barter money. Barter money. Barter money. The important aspect of barter money, well, there are actually two, but I'll give you one right now. One of the important aspects of barter money is that the money itself has full intrinsic value. In other words, you could trade that pie for a moose, or you could completely and fully and absolutely eat that pie, the whole thing. You understand? That makes barter money very special money. It has full intrinsic value. The next kind of money has some intrinsic value. It is sometimes called metal money, or sometimes you'll hear me call it commodity money. Like gold. Gold is widely accepted in exchange. However, it can also be used to a certain extent. You see, you can't fully use gold. Gold is pretty. You can make pretty things with it. But you can't use it as completely as you could use a pie. Have you ever tried to eat a gold coin? Tasteless, even with kosher salt. Nothing. You see, the gold and other, and there have been other metals. Silver has been historically very popular. And all of that. Platinum, copper, other kinds of, obviously certain types of gemstones. Diamonds are only one kind. Historically, you've had other kinds that have been popular. Rubies, sapphires, garnets, alexandrite, you name it. But they don't have full intrinsic value. You cannot fully consume them. Okay? They come back. Once you eat that pie, or once I eat that pie, the pie's gone. But once you've used gold, you can probably use it again. Okay? Once you use copper, you could probably use it again. I went to look at a trailer out in Lexington to rent. And unfortunately, the trailer had been gutted of all the copper in it, because the copper was valuable. First, it was valuable for the piping in the trailer, and then it was valuable to steal and trade for money in a with a fence that deals in copper. Okay, so now, the last kind of, actually, this isn't the last one. Interestingly enough, only the last couple of years have I had to change what I've been teaching for 35 years. I used to say the last one is, but it's not anymore. But this is the one that you most likely think of when you think of money. This money has no intrinsic value at all. It does. There's nothing you can do. Well, I suppose you can use it for toilet paper or for a snot rag, but other than that, it doesn't have any value whatsoever. None. And that is important, because that distinguishes it from the other two. This money is widely accepted only because the sovereign orders us to accept it. This is what is called fiat money. It's actually, this word is pronounced fiat, but we're Americans, so we don't pronounce things right. But fiat money is money only by decree of the sovereign. It says right here, you have to accept this in exchange, or we will throw you in jail. You have to accept it. Fiat money has no intrinsic value. Go. It was still fiat because the government said that the paper was exchangeable for gold. You understand? But actually, it wasn't gold standard. We were not on the gold standard. Realistically, we were on a silver standard at the level of people. You see, I could go into a bank and I could get four quarters for a dollar, because the dollar was a silver certificate and the quarters were made of silver. That's why it was a silver certificate. So the baseline of people, it was a... It was essentially a silver standard. But at the gold standard level, and the reason that the gold standard was, everyone said, we got to go back to gold standard. Well, you're as dumb as a box of rocks, you idiot. Every time we've tried that, you look at some of the tries at gold standards in history. Bad idea from beginning to end. You know why there are shipwrecks with gold in them? Because they put the gold on the cheapest ships in their fleets. Because there was so much gold at several times historically that it was creating so much inflation that it was insane. So they had to start having ships sink with gold. Otherwise, gold was creating more aggregate price level rises. Gold is no magic. It's just another thing, and especially if you get into gold, if you're watching too many gold sites and you're listening to people who are called, we call gold bugs, you really, really need to go get a girlfriend or something, okay? Seriously, don't be enamored with gold. It's just a metal. It's just a metal. It's pretty metal. I mean, you know, but it's just a metal. There's another one here now, unfortunately. Like I said, throughout history, I mean, I've been teaching this for, my God, it scares me that I'm actually older than many of your parents, which just pisses me off. But anyway, look, there's a new kid on the block. I did run the finance club. Now I run the economics club. And I bring in these people who are specialists in this. They're called hashers. And if I have a chance, with the club, I'll bring the hashers in. And if any of you are interested in hashing or that whole world, well, there's a den I can take you to here in town where they do this stuff. This is not a world that is pleasant if you get off the track. Cryptocurrencies. Does anyone think of a cryptocurrency? Yeah? Bitcoin, classic. And it's not the only one, don't get me wrong. But that's the one that I'm the most involved in with the hashers, although I'm not crazy like those guys are. I mean, to hash, you have to have a super heavy-duty gaming-level computer, and you're... Huh? Yeah, hash. Don't say farm. Hash, okay? It sounds butch. So, but they just drink electricity. I mean, cryptocurrencies are being collected all over the world. The North Koreans and the Chinese use prison slave labor by the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, just mining the coins day and night. Our treasury is trumping up phony charges against hashers just to take their bitcoins away from them. Some of the heaviest investment banks have quietly amassed stashes of crypto. So it's there, it's highly unstable. The volatility of the exchange rate is just insane, from day to day, hour to hour. And also, you're playing in the dark web. Quick point about the dark web. No. The dark web, if you stay on a very narrow path, you play in the world of the hash. But if you step off that world, you're in serious. You're on Silk Road, where you can buy anything from an assassin to a drug that makes you look like an aardvark. You can go and get access through channels to watch a nightly movie where they kill a girl. Seriously. You can go to places like Lolita City. I mean, this is seriously twisted, bent place. And down at the bottom of it, people like me have probed for Mariana. And whoever is running the program that makes this world of ours. But I mean, it's a crazy, creepy, weird world. And cryptocurrencies are in that world. And it's a very interesting place. It's just not a place you want to play in. If you're the kind of person who doesn't want to walk on a path through the woods, you want to go off and find some magic mushrooms or something, don't go in the deep web. Leave it alone. Leave it to other crazies. Anyway, like I said, now here's the interesting thing. I don't talk too much about cryptocurrencies. I don't know if there are any other finance professors who are even talking about it. I know I was criticized very heavily when I brought the hashers in here. And if, like I said, I'll bring them in again for my club this semester so they can just teach you, getting your mind around what cryptocurrency is. It's not, people say, well, it's just like a fiat, or it's like a, no, it is something very new, very different. And it's a dangerous thing, too. But I'll bring in a couple of people to the club. They'll teach the basics of it. And then there's a hasher's den in Uptown Normal, if anyone's interested in seeing what they do when they're mining, when they're farming. Who said farming? Okay, don't go in there wearing overalls, okay? If anyone's interested in it, I don't know if anyone's interested in it or not. Here's first things first. The idea that there has been coin money all over the place, all through history, is actually a myth. Money in the hands, fiat money, even metal money, in the hands of commoners, that is a modern thing. I mean, throughout history, for the most part, the commoners worked for in a barter way. They were paid their wage not in coin and paper. They were paid in stuff that they could consume immediately. A story that I tell, it's mostly in economics classes, but I mention it here, is that in ancient Egypt, we have this mythical idea that the pyramids were built by hundreds of thousands of grunting, groaning, moaning, miserable slaves. They weren't. They were built by highly skilled professionals. There were teams, athletic teams that did the building, intellectual teams that did the scribing, incredibly mathematical teams that did the mathematics, which was awesome, freaking awesome. Even to this day, that's cool stuff they did. They were pros. As a matter of fact, if you go into the pyramids, go into the back chambers, when they would finish building a section, a team of these athletic young men, they would write the insignia of their team. They gave themselves names like Tigers and Lions and Pumas. They were just like sports teams of our age, and they took pride. We did this. This is our chamber right here. That was how pro they were. The same was true of the scribes. They were elitists. They looked down on everybody. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that all of these groups lived in construction villages around the building of a pyramid, around a pyramid. Now, the Egyptians were famous for chronicling everything that happened in their world. Their wars, the ones they won, the ones they lost, everything they wrote down. Romances, intrigue, everything. The good, the bad, and the ugly, and they were bluntly, brutally honest. So there was this one, and also understand that the idea of these pharaohs that were seen as gods, and everyone fell down and groveled to them, and everyone went like this, and no, a lot of the pharaohs were hated. One of the most hated of all of the pharaohs, everyone hated him, was Cheops. He was building this insane multi-decade project, the pyramids of Cheops. And it was draining the economy. It was killing off production, private production, and all of that. And he was screwing over these workers in the construction city. Now, they were not paid in money, though. The workers of that time were paid in food, booze, and companionship. And I won't go any further with that last one. Let it go. Walk away from it. Okay. But they were not being paid well at all. Cheops was a chintzy son of a bitch. And so when he built that pyramid, he was screwing over pros, and they went on strike. They just went on strike. No, we're not going to build it. So the inner circle of the pharaoh, Cheops, there was a lot of debate. Well, what we need to do is we need to execute these people. That's how we're going to deal with this. Just kill them. That'll set an example. And then some wiser head said, no. You see, if you kill off some of them, to make an example, those scribes, they're going to, you know, when they write those things, those hieroglyphs, to tell you where to go in the afterlife, they're going to send you to a toilet dump on the other side of Samaria. No, you moron. Oh, and also those guys who build the pyramids, they know exactly how to make a pyramid so it stands for 5,000 years, and how to make a pyramid so it falls down on your rotting carcass the next day. No, you're not going to screw them over. You're going to blink. And Cheops did. And that was the end of it. I think it was Cheops that was the one who this happened to. The first recorded labor strike in human history. But it wasn't for money. It was for barter. Well, it wasn't for money like we think. It was for barter. He increased the rations magnificently, and everyone was happy, and it was all over. But the idea that money is historically been coins and currencies, you had these guys riding around with coins in their little pouches, not really. That's modern. Even to this day. You, sir, how much money do you have in your pocket? Whoa, you're better than most people in this room. Seriously, noob. You're buying at Meatheads. Someone more normal. Okay, here's what I've got. Okay. Well, shoot. $2. We'll go to hell. Look, even to this day, commoners, back in my time, you were known by how thick your wallet was. But anymore, we just keep it in the bank. We don't carry money even to this day. We keep it in something other than currency. Now, I'm going to bring up a term for you. Liquidity. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted to another asset. Liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be converted into another asset. Now, I want to point out here that some people will say liquidity is the efficiency with which an asset can be turned into cash. That's a bad definition, simply because cash has a liquidity. You see, what you want to know is it highly liquid or is it illiquid? So, for example, if you look at this list of types of money, liquidity is actually going up as you go toward the more modern currencies, the more modern monies. I mean, an apple pie barter, that is not actually a very liquid thing. I mean, you know, you might have someone who trades you something for a pie, but you might not. And even if someone might have something you want, but they don't want a pie. They don't like pie. God knows why, but they don't like pie. Metal. You know, there are some people who say, I don't want metal. Don't give me... Let me ask you this. Oh, well, I've picked on you enough. Let me do this. Madam, have you ever gone through a drive-thru for food? You know, snarf and barf or inhale and flail? Well, okay. So have you ever tried to go up to McDonald's? I would like a sandwich, McPlease. Okay, that will be $18. Please pull through to the first McWindow. And you hand them a gold coin, and they're going to say, Mc, what is this? You see, that coin isn't going to get you your burger. They're going to have to argue and talk about it and flail around and decide whether it's worth it or not. They probably won't even try. You understand that it's actually that metal money is not as liquid as you might think it is. So another thing, you back a highly liquid fiat with a less liquid metal, you got an interesting mismatch, liquidity mismatch right there, which unfortunately got taken advantage of terribly. We were stupid. We nearly lost our entire gold reserve. We lost most of it after World War II because we'd done something stupid. We had treated metal gold as if it were a liquid commodity, which it is not. And we don't have nearly as much gold as we had 100 years ago at Fort Knox. But anyway, okay. So you see, now here's another interesting thing. Madam, how much are you worth?
Not much.
You quit it with that emo stuff. You are worth, you are.
Money-wise, I'm not.
But you see, you know, if I were to liquidate you right now, what, you know, some salt and some meat and I could sell in certain troubled markets, but maybe only about right away, I could probably get about $12 for you. Okay? However, if I work you in the long run and look at the present value of your future expected net cash flows, I'm talking about, well, in a case like yours, about $10, $12 million. And if you turn out to be a super giant star of corporate America, a lot more than that. But you see that money is going to come slowly, extracted piece by piece. So in other words, you are an incredibly valuable asset, but it is a highly illiquid asset. You understand the idea there? That value and liquidity are not related that way. Now there's another thing too, interestingly enough, that is related to this. Madam, I am going to pretend that you have $50,000. Okay. Now, if you could keep that $50,000 in your backpack, okay? Now, are you actually going to do that?
No, it's not safe there.
Okay, there's a risk factor, but there's another factor too. How much do you earn off that $50,000 if it sits there in your backpack?
Nothing.
How much would it earn if you put it into an investment? You wouldn't know, but it could earn more, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you understand that having the liquidity is at the opportunity cost of the best foregone alternative investment. You could get over that risk thing by putting it under your mattress, okay? Do you have any cats? Dogs?
No.
Okay. I was going to say you could put it in the dog kennel with a vicious dog. It'd be safe there, but it's still, the risk factor could be removed, but you would still lose the potential for earnings on it. So liquidity, when we look at companies, and I'm going to, that's one of the things we'll do in this course, we're going to look at financial ratios. And a whole set of financial ratios revolves around a company's liquidity. Do they have money to pay their bills quickly? But that is not a great thing. Liquidity can be too low. You should have more money in, where you can get to it quickly. Or it can be too high. Why do you have all this money? Why aren't you investing this in a new factory or in some new research and development? So we have to watch it. Too little liquidity is scary. Too much liquidity is foolish. So you understand that liquidity has all of these different facets to it. It's not a simple concept at all. And that's one of the things that you're going to be facing as you get older into your professional lives. At first, you're going to want to have high liquidity. We know that about people as they begin professions. That first check of yours for $5,000, oh yeah, oh yeah. Put that where you can get it out of the ATM and partay. But then as time goes on, you begin to reduce your liquidity because you realize that liquidity is not the best thing in the world to have. Sure, you have a big wad of cash in your pocket, you can find a friend for an entire evening, possibly. But you're giving up money that you could invest by doing it. Money, there's an opportunity cost to it. So I wanted to bring up this concept of liquidity, important as it is early in the course. Now, as far as liquidity goes, the two most liquid instruments are cash, and on the other side are U.S. Treasury bills, short-term debt instruments. I mean, because you can turn a Treasury bill into money just instantly. That's why when in the next lecture, it'll be partly, I'll mention it in this one. The banks are measured. One of the ways that we look at banks these days, to look at safety of the bank, is we look at their Tier 1 capital. They're high quality liquid assets. They're good stuff. Now, when we look at liquidity of a bank, we look how much cash does the bank have and how many treasury bills does the bank have. Because both of those are highly safe, highly liquid. But we also have to appreciate that banks can't just keep every deposit in cash and T-bills. We know the bank has to invest, has to, if it wants to make money, it's got to lend money to other people. It's got to put money into projects in the community or something like that. So it's a trade-off here. But do keep in mind that liquidity is important. Liquidity is safety, but it's also at the expense of profitability. Okay? All right. Banks have been around for a long, long, long time. The thing of it is that there were banks or banking families clear in the Middle Ages. Actually, they were in Roman times, but I kind of separate once the Visigoths sacked Rome for the last time in 476, in AD 476. It's sort of like that reset the whole system. So once we get into the Middle Ages, we began to see threads of banking going on. Wealthy, powerful interests. And these weren't always the sovereigns. They were noblemen at first, but then these trades craftsmen got into the game of money. As a matter of fact, by the time you get to the 1300s, the kings of England were so interested in prosecuting their stupid fights with the French that they actually borrowed money from the Beermeister's Guild to prosecute their stupid wars. And the French kings and queens were doing the same thing. They were borrowing money from this rising middle class of artisans and craftsmen to prosecute these stupid wars and to build more castles. Because basically the sovereigns were busted. They were broke. They had assets, but they were highly illiquid assets. And they couldn't even raise armies to fight with each other in their petty wars because they didn't have anything to give them. So they had, and that was one of the worst things too, was because after these wars were over in Europe and England, the armies just were sent, you're done, go away. And so these armies turned into rogue mercenary bandit companies. And it was just awful the way they just rove the countryside, pillaging and stealing and destroying everything in their sight. But anyway, the point I'm trying to get to is that there were banks showing up, mostly backed by powerful, wealthy families. Although governments were involved too. In the later Middle Ages, actually in the middle to later Middle Ages, we began to see the rise of the fairs. Fairs were the central gatherings where merchants, buyers, and sellers of goods would come together to trade. And there were fairs in Europe. One famous one, there was a song written about it called Scarborough Fair in England. Two oldies sang that song, Simon and Garfunkel. But these fairs were all over the place. Now, interestingly enough, with these fairs, there were banking interests backing the merchants. Because let's say that I wanted to go to a fair to buy goods. I am a Brit, and I decide I think I can sell Italian goods in Britain. What I would do is I'd go to this fair. Now, the Italian merchant selling Italian stuff isn't going to be interested in anything I've got as far as a money would be concerned. Maybe gold, but I'm not going to carry gold with me. I'm not stupid. Travel all that way to let highwaymen take my stuff. So what I would probably do is I would have an agreement with my bank that I could write a draft against my deposits with the bank. And I could give it to this Italian merchant. He knew it was good. What he would do is take that to his bank, his Italian bank, trade it for lira, or the currency of the time there. And then those two banks would work out the deal to get the lira and the pound sterling straightened out. it created liquidity in the market, and it made it so that the merchants could deal with each other without the worry of the intervening currencies. Those banknotes became currency themselves. If I was a merchant with a British guy's banknote, well, I might even just go back to Britain and trade some stuff of mine in for British stuff and use that British banknote and give it to the British merchant at the Scarborough Fair. So suddenly you have a new kind of security. A security backed by a bank, a security which was basically a currency, a dollar bill. You might have that paper trade 5 or 6 times before it ever found its way back to the bank of original backing. That is the beginning of a modern banking system. By the time we get to the 16, 1700s, we begin to see the early predecessors of central banks. In other words, a bank that was sort of like a country's bank. Okay, that kind of came, especially with some of these families, like in Italy, the de' Medicis. I mean, they were powerful. They had banking interests. They had mining interests. They were supporting the arts. I mean, it's hilarious to this day. Well, this music from the classical ages was timeless. That's why it's classical. No, it was just because some rich person liked it and funded this person who would otherwise have been nothing. If Mozart hadn't had some fancies who liked him, he would have been put in an insane asylum because it was a crazy mofo. His music was wretched. But the truth was that these banking interests were supporting the arts, the sciences, the travels to the New World to bring back really cool stuff. And so we had the central banks begin, a country's bank. They would fund the king's. They would fund the little petty tyrants. They would fund the adventures into the new worlds or the travels to China and back. Okay, so now, in the 1800s, you had full-blown central banks in Europe. We didn't. We in the United States just had this mishmash of a lot of awful things that called themselves bank. All manner of cat strangler, dog beater, child whacker, nose picker. It was just a mishmash. You had these sod banks showing up out of nowhere that would collapse within a year or two. They would write paper against the bank that they'd say was money, and then after a year or two, it would be worth nothing, and the people who had put their money in for the sod bank paper had nothing as a result of it. I mean, it was just an awful situation. You get to the period after the Civil War. The United States had the best government money could buy. It was run by powerful bosses, literally, who would decide who was going to be president, who was going to be a senator, a representative, who was going to be a judge, who was going to be the police commissioner, the whole nine yards. It was run by plutocrats. Everyone knew it. The newspapers made jokes and fun of it. Cartoonists just had a heyday. It was just a joke what was going on. And the banking system was awful because the belief was that the best government regulation was no government regulation whatsoever. Free markets are the best markets. That's what Adam Smith said. No, that's actually not what Adam Smith said. That was what some of his right-wing followers said. But whatever happens, that's for the best. That makes everything the most efficient. So the strong survive, the weak are destroyed, all that good stuff. Well, here's how it would work. In the banking system, oh shit, there's a lot of people out there. Hey, what's going on? Hi, everybody. They're looking at me like I'm weird. I mean, they're all out there yelling and farting at each other. Okay. Where the hell was I? Okay. The banks, there were good banks, don't get me wrong, but there were a lot of scams. And there were good people who got suckered into representing scams. The great general Ulysses S. Grant was talked into putting his name on an investment scam. And because his name was on it, almost every Union soldier pledged his pension to this scam. And they lost everything. And Grant died from throat cancer, knowing that he had ruined the lives of all of those men who had fought for the federal government. But now, when you have a bank, you're going to have bank money, you're going to have people deposit money. Now, you could keep all of that money. You'd have high liquidity so that if anyone came in, they could get their money back right away. But that would be insane because then you couldn't make any money. What you've got to do is keep a fraction of it for people to have if they need it back, and then to lend the rest out or invest it in something. So there is a natural tendency to have a fractional reserve system where banks keep part of their money. Now, the whole trick is to have enough money so that you can meet potential demand for deposits, but have not so much that you're giving up good investments and making good loans. So let's say that you are a good bank and you keep 20% of deposits. And that's actually, we found that over time, when banks are left and there's not a central bank to tell them what reserve ratio, they'll all come to an agreement. Well, everyone's pretty confident about banks, so we'll have 10%. Well, people are a little iffy, so let's take it up to 20%, just in case there's a lot of people coming. But now, what we can then go and talk about is this lousy, scoundrel-oriented, dog-beating con man who runs a bank. He gets a bunch of people to put money into it, and then he goes out and spends it like a blind trout on wine, women, and song, and he doesn't like music that much. So you go into his bank and he says, don't have your money. Well, you have a cow. You go back out and you yell at this guy, you know he's got money in there, and you say, moo. And he says, moo? Yeah, moo. And then you tell you I got money in the bank, and so everyone runs your bank, and you're just fold up your last seat and leaving town in a late model Huff. But what happens is that freaks out the depositors in your bank. Did you hear about that bank down the road that collapsed? So they start running your bank, and you don't have enough for everyone who comes in, and your bank just collapses. His bank collapses. His bank collapses. It's a domino. One bad bank can create a run on a bunch of banks, and then you have everyone in the bank, everyone who's deposited money has lost their savings. All because of one bad apple. That was what was happening in the late 1800s. There was no one to regulate. There was no one to stop him from doing it. The best hope you could have of justice was to pop a cap in his ass. If you couldn't find him, well, you were just lost. But it was even worse than that, you see. He didn't have to be in the system. He didn't. Got a good bank? You got a good bank, and you got a good bank. You're a depositor in her bank?
Yeah.
Did you know that she doesn't have the money to give you your money back? Did you know it? Did you know it? Did you know it? she doesn't have the money to give you your money back. Well, if I were you, I'd go in there and get your money out before anyone else does. And suddenly at her door, all of them are, and you don't have that much money. Sure, you'd have money for a normal day, but when everyone comes in there, you say, what the hell? Your bank folds. And then I come in. How you doing, my fine lady? I would like to buy your bank for a penny on the dollar. My name is Professor Rothschild. You understand what the big rich families were doing? They were creating artificial runs on decent banks, destroying them, and then buying them up and monopolizing the banking system in one big city after another after another. That's how those rich families got so filthy rich. It was a con game. And there was no one to stop them from doing it. There was no regulation. Why would we have regulation? The best government is no government. Free markets. The strong survive, the weak fall, and you were just weak, weren't you? You knew how to lock those doors, keep those people from bothering you. You understand that in order to stop this, the problem is, and I really don't like doing this, but I'm going to have to do it anyway. Ma'am, you mean nothing. Neither do I. You? Nothing. You? Oh, less than nothing, you. You? We mean nothing. If we get hurt, if we get screwed over, if we are financially destroyed, no one in the world is going to give a rat's. They're going to hold the rat upside down. See this rat's ass? That's what we give. Oh, no, we don't even give that. Go away, rat. You see, when all these middle class and poor and working poor were destroyed in these bank runs, no one cared. Because your vote didn't matter anyway. You weren't going to change the system. Oh, we're going to change the system. No, you're not. Oh, we'll join a union. Oh, yeah, we'll have the cops because we hire the commissioner. We rich people do. We'll show you what happens when you get into that kind of nonsense. Oh, yeah. Cry all you want. Boo-hoo. Cry me a river. You're not going to do anything. But you see, what happened was they got so greedy playing these banking games that a few rich people started getting nicked. And a few politicians' relatives started getting nicked. And then economy at the macro level started shaking. And these recessions that kept showing up, and they kept tracing them back to these bank runs. And suddenly it then became a problem even for the people who were controlling the capital. They saw that there needed to be something done. So we began to see reforms. Actually, the first reform of... There was a reform called the Sherman Antitrust Act. At the end of the 1890s, starting to crack down on the monopolies. It turned out to be pretty toothless. I mean, but there was a learning going on. And interestingly enough, when we get to the second decade of the 20th century, the 19-teens, you saw a very strange window of reformers coming into office. The president was a reformer, and Congress had in its mind, we've got to clean up some stuff. They tightened up the Sherman Antitrust Act, and they put in some other legislation that would be considered quite modern in an age when free market economics was still the rule of the day. And even in an era when the Supreme Court was still well in the pockets of the wealthy and would shoot down legislation that was too anti-business, you started seeing things showing up that were really weird. And one thing that was interesting, too, was that you saw that our legislature was maturing. It was starting to learn how to create legislation that actually worked. It's one thing for the federal government to pass a law, but who's going to prosecute? Who's going to make that law work? The federal police? Well, prosecute? No, they're not going to. They don't have the time for this. So what they had begun to learn back in the 1800s is if you're going to create a law about something, a law of things, you will have to create in that law an agency that will enforce the law, that will interpret it and enforce it. The first such thing happened with the Interstate Commerce Commission. The Interstate Commerce Act in the 1800s actually created a commission that would oversee enforcement of the interstate commerce law. Okay, so we get, and then we saw this, the Federal Trade Commission. This reformist mentality in the 19-teens, they created laws to protect businesses and consumers from rip-off artists. But they knew that there was going to be no way to enforce these laws unless they created an agency to enforce them. So we had the Federal Trade Commission came into play. And we realized we were going to have to create a central bank if we were going to get the banking system under control. It wouldn't be enough to pass laws. We were going to have to actually create a governing body that would see to it that those laws crack down on the banking system. Now, this was done with the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. It created the Federal Reserve System, and it laid out the law of the land for banks. Now, the Fed, don't use the term the Fed. That's an amateur's term. You call it the Federal Reserve. I guarantee you. Now, the Fed, it began with three duties. Three duties. Now, before I get to that, let me make sure you understand. The Federal Reserve Act created the Federal Reserve System. There is a board of governors. There are seven of these people. One of them is the chairman. Don't let me bluff you on a quiz. The board of governors, there are seven governors and a chairman. No, the chairman is one of the seven. These governors are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. Historically, they have been the cream of the crop, although in the last 15 years, you got some pretty dodgy people showing up in the board. Got one person on the board who used to be a dinner theater actress, and then she ran a bank until it collapsed and it was bought by Wachovia. It was so bad that Wachovia gave her money so that if she promised she would never do anything for the bank again. But anyway, the seven governors. Historically, it was the classic old white boys group. In more recent years, it has got more diversity in terms of women participating, being on the board, and people of color and Hispanics. Interestingly enough, the current chair, who's the chair of the Federal Reserve right now? Yeah? Janet Yellen? Interestingly enough, and I don't understand this, honestly, and I haven't been up or haven't talked to any of my people in Chicago or St. Louis in quite a while. I keep seeing this reference now to the co-chairman. There was never that before, but somehow there is now. I don't know what that's all about. Okay, now, the Board of Governors regulates the banking system. It takes laws passed by Congress and turns them into actionable rules for banks. Now, when the Fed was created, the act divided the United States into 12 districts. Strangely, back then, the West was still pretty quiet, So the districts out west are huge compared to the districts east. And now it's like the San Francisco Fed District Bank is just like over a huge amount of work it does. Okay, so 12 districts. And so there are 12, there's one district bank in each district. Although there are, some of the districts have more than one branch. We here where we are actually very close to the boundary between two different districts, the Chicago and the St. Louis. Here we're in the Chicago, but you go maybe I guess like 30 miles south of here and you're in the St. Louis district. Now the district banks, each district bank has a district president. So there are 12 district presidents. And that'll become important when in this tomorrow or next week. Now, these district bank presidents are the cream of the crop from finance, economics, and accounting. They are the consummate intellectual business people. I've met two of them. They're just like, I mean, these people, I don't think they even have sex. They're like so perfect. I was actually intimidated. Now, most people don't intimidate me, but I was afraid they could make me throttle me, just point, you have failed me for the last time, fat boy. Anyway, yes. But so these district bank presidents, these banks supervise. So the board regulates, and then they tell the district banks what to look for, what to enforce, how to interpret the law. And so they go out and they manage the member banks. Now I'm going to give you a caution here in a minute. So the Federal Reserve has three duties. Duty one is to regulate and supervise member banks. But here's where the first problem comes in. After the banking crisis dust had settled, Congress started hauling in banks and Fed people and said, what in the hell? Why didn't you watch these banks? And the Fed said, these aren't our banks. We're not allowed to watch these. These banks are under the control of this agency. Okay, agency, why didn't you watch it? Well, those banks aren't ours. Those banks are theirs. There are all these different bodies that watch different kinds of banks. There are banks that the Fed watches. Then there are banks that the states watch because the states, they're state charter. So the feds have no regulatory power over them. And then there are these banks that are watched by the comptroller of the currency. And then there are banks that are watched by the FDIC. And then credit unions, they got their own agency that watches them. It's a crazy quilt. Well, here a few congressmen said, all right, we're going to crack down. You're all going to be under one supervision. Oh, turf war. I guarantee you that didn't happen. Oh, no, you're not going to touch our banks. Our banks are ours. And you had all these different agencies crying crocodile tears to their favorite legislators. And then you had the big, heavy 10 largest banks in the world, the corruptest, crippled children. The Fed has poured $15 trillion to keep those miserable animals alive. They have so much power that one of the most corrupt of them, the president of one of those banks, struts into Congress, and you should have seen the senators and the representatives groveling at that man's feet, slobbering over the man who had single-handedly nearly destroyed the world economy. There were only two senators who stood up to him, fearless. The rest of them, and it's on YouTube. It's a joke seeing this dirty, corrupt man who has siphoned $15 trillion with his fellow banksters. And there those senators were playing pussyfoot with that man at congressional hearings. well, you're obviously not responsible for this, and we appreciate all you've done for us. Oh, God. Anyway, second one. Serves as a bank for banks. Banks need a bank. The Fed will do it. But interestingly enough, the Fed actually competes against private commercial banks. By law, the Fed can't charge, can't hurt them on fees, and everything that the Fed does as far as technological research, it has to share for free with its private commercial competitors. Its private commercial competitors make a fortune. The Fed actually makes a fortune every year, and it just gives that money to the Treasury. An example of a public agency that coexists perfectly with private competition. I tried to write to several and get meetings with several congressmen back when they were talking about national health insurance. I said, here's your model. This has been going on for almost 100 years. Oh, well, that, I don't understand that. Damn, this is works. It works. And everyone, the fees are low to banks. The private sector does fine. The Fed does fine with this. No one wanted to hear. And then the third one, which we'll get into next week, the Fed conducts monetary policy. That's enough for tonight. That's all I have for you. I thank you.